Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. In today's special seminar, we have a very special guest, Mr. Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy, a publicly traded company that has just announced the purchase of more than $400 million worth of Bitcoin to add on to use as their primary treasury asset. Mr. Saylor has very gracefully and thankfully accepted my invitation to come and join us in the seminar so we can discuss his company's move and how it relates to Bitcoin and the Bitcoin standard, seeing that he publicly said that this was an attempt to put his company on a Bitcoin standard. So I think we'll hopefully find a lot to discuss and a lot of common ground. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. So I guess from a selfish perspective and from the perspective of many of the people in this seminar, I guess we could probably begin by asking you, we know that you've read the Bitcoin Standard, but what did you think? What were your impressions?
I will say that I read the book. It blew my mind, and I thought that you put together all of the technical and economic and motivational and related issues better than anything that I've seen. So I guess I guess the best compliment I can give you is I read your book and I invested $425 million in Bitcoin. but actually, you know, there's some people that read about Bitcoin and they decide they're going to buy some. And there are some people that read about it, you know, first it's a speculation, I'm going to buy some. And then some people read about it, think I'm going to buy a lot. And some people read about Bitcoin and they think it's cool technology and they want to get on the train. I think that the Bitcoin standard is amazing because it got me over those hurdles to realize that it's not really about buying a lot. It's actually about inverting the balance sheet of the company. What we were doing was we were inverting the balance sheet such that we're floating on a Bitcoin sale, right? On a crypto sale, if you will. And as the liquidity and the monetary system gets pumped up, we want it to float rather than sink on that pool of liquidity. And I think that lots of other people in the Bitcoin industry have written a lot of stuff that's very interesting, but I thought that your book put it all together in a very compelling way. And so it was probably the most impactful of all the stuff I looked at on our way of thinking.
Well, thank you very much.
I like the book. It was a work of genius. Okay, good.
Thank you.
It shattered my illusions about money, right? Like at the point in the book where you say that in the last decade, the monetary system's expanding by 7% a year. You know, I think we've been conditioned to think, well, 2% inflation, therefore 2% monetary expansion. And it never registered with me that even in normal times, you were getting 7% monetary expansion or 8%. And then once I saw that, it all clicked for me. And I realized that a lot of the problem that we had was we were sitting on too much cash. And if you have $500 million in cash and you make $500 million in operating income every year, then you have $35 million in after-tax cash flow, which is equal to 7% of your cash balance, which meant that our asset purchasing power was deteriorating as fast as we were generating income, and we weren't going to get ahead no matter how hard we worked. And it was a big epiphany, and that was before 2020. Obviously, after 2020, things changed.
Yeah, I mean, I was really intrigued by your discussion with Stefan Levera in his podcast on inflation, which it's a drum that I've beaten for many, many years. But I thought your idea of saying that inflation, that there are three types of goods within an economy, the goods that drop in price every year, technology, and goods that require heavy or high initial fixed costs and then slow marginal costs, these tend to decline in price. And then you have the goods that rise at a small rate, you know, labor and land, basically undifferentiated labor and land, if you want, you know, the not the most skilled labor and not the most desirable land and property. These things appreciate at around 1, 2, 3, give or take, every year. And then there's the desirable, truly scarce things that people compete for. And these are the things where the inflation is 6, 7, 8%, and maybe even up to 20% a year. And I think that was a really, really eye-opening way of thinking about it. And I have not thought about it before. I'm wondering if you've written something about this somewhere or if you've come across it somewhere, because I think it's a very useful framework that I intend to use in my next book. So where do I cite that?
I mean, the truth of the matter is, again, it's back to this propaganda rule. We can't tell people what to think. We can tell them what to think about. If we keep repeating inflation is CPI, 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 and then everybody thinks CPI, we didn't get 2%. Oh, there's no inflation. Everybody's waiting for inflation. As soon as you, the big misconception is that a number is a scalar. And of course, anybody in engineering, you know, if you're studying fluid dynamics, there's not a number, it's a vector. And a vector could be a stack of, if I stacked up 100 different things, I can give you 100 different inflation rates. And if I and I could give you a two-dimensional vector, and I could give you a three-dimensional vector, right? And vector calculus and fluid dynamics gets pretty complicated. It's if I said to you, look at the swirl of the water, you know, in a whirlpool, and you asked me, well, what's the velocity of the water? I would say, well, it depends. It's a vector. It depends upon which component you pick out. So the truth is, I bought into the lie of CPI until I read your book, Saifedean. And then, you know, at that point, it's like, oh, it's going up 7%. And then I thought, wow, everything that I really want to buy is going up. You know, my MIT education went up more than 2%. Healthcare goes up more than 2%. I got a house in Miami Beach on 2 acres, cost $100,000 in 1930. It would cost you $20 million today. It didn't go up 2%. And I started thinking, well, everything's scarce. And then I thought, Hampton's real estate doesn't go up 2%. Manhattan real estate doesn't go up 2%. Okay, and then it tricked to this horrific observation that a $1 million bond yields $50,000 in 2010. And then a million dollar bond today gives you $5,000. So a bond went up by 1,000% in 10 years. And then you back solve that and you say, that's 22% inflation per year in the last decade. And that's before we hit the financial crisis. And then I realized, right, the inflation rates, you could calculate a different one depending upon the labor intensity, the material intensity, and the information intensity of the thing that you choose to track. So we know that when I wrote the mobile wave in 2012, my thesis was mobile networks are dematerializing products and services. And that means if you dematerialize a camera, or you dematerialize a photo, or you dematerialize a DVD or a CD or a tape recorder, right? And on your iPhone, you've got a tape recorder and you've got a camera and you dematerialize a credit card. I mean, all these things that they dematerialize, they're deflationary and they're going to zero. And the reason Apple's the most valuable company on earth is because they can ship a dematerialized product to 1 billion people for a nickel. There's never going to be any inflation if you want to measure that. Put that in your market basket because there's no variable cost. And then you just have to come up with a vector of all these things. And of course, what's got a variable cost? Well, if I give you a piece of paper that gives you the right to never work again the rest of your life and have as much money as you want, would you like that? Right? That's scarce. That's going up, right? Because Apple can't dematerialize infinite power and money forever, right? So that's what Bitcoin is, right?
Yeah.
Power and money forever, right? So what happens? I mean, you point out in your book, and I read all your papers after your book. You kept me up late, Saifedean, the last two nights. I'm reading all your papers. And I'm thinking, anything that goes up in price that mankind can manufacture, given enough time and money and, you know, and chemistry. So you think, well, fracking, right? The solution to the oil crisis was not to go to war in the Gulf. The solution to the oil crisis was let the price of oil go up. And when the price of oil got to $100 a barrel, then Wall Street raised $50 billion worth of capital, put it into fracking, invented fracking, and doubled the oil production in the United States. And the problem that was a 100-year-old problem that everybody kept talking about, the scarcity of oil, became a non-problem. So the real question is, across all this array of products and services, you know, you want your nails done, you want your hair cut, you know, you want a Caesar salad prepared tableside. Caesar salads tableside require by a person with a tuxedo and a nice haircut that's polite and speaks your language, going to be more expensive. So the real issue is, can I manufacture with a robot? And but if I can, what's the variable cost? And as the variable cost falls and as the capital intensity increases, it becomes less deflationary. And of course, the companies that are worth more money than God right now, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, all have the same thing in common. They're manufacturing products and services with a zero variable cost. If everybody at Google went on vacation for the rest of the year and didn't show up to work, every single one of them, you probably wouldn't notice. Like YouTube would keep working, Google would keep working. There's not a single person involved in delivery of the value proposition. The only thing they're doing is creating the next version of the information factory. So you would notice in 2021 when they don't add a new feature to YouTube. But in fact, the variable cost of Google is electricity and data. It's the data center, right? It's the electricity and the server spinning. So, you know, really, once you come to that conclusion, there's a vector. Let's just make it a one-dimensional array. Let's make it an array of, you could, it's not, I described three buckets, but Saifedean, the really interesting thing is, right, there's, would anybody have guessed that the most inflationary, the best asset is a government bond yielding 3% interest, right? That seems the stupidest thing you could possibly buy, right, if you're a rational person. But the long bond index went up by 22% this year. On January 1st, if you had bought 30-year government bonds yielding 2%, you would have made a 25% capital gain. So you've got 25% inflation. You know, S&P can show you 8% inflation. I can find you, you know, New York, Manhattan. You want a penthouse on a penthouse on wall on Central Park that's 8,000 square feet with a perfect view? Seems kind of scarce. It is scarce, but if you go to $100 million and Ken Griffin offers $100 million, they will build you a 100-story skyscraper on a pad, and they built a bunch of them on Billionaires Row, and they'll sell you one apartment for $100 million. It's, you know, at a certain price, and there's floors 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, right? There's a lot of scarcity if you build up. So there's an entire theory, I guess, of inflation. By the way, a theory of inflation, everybody says, well, you're only inflating 2% a year or 3%. Well, if asset inflation is a vector too. S&P went up 8%, bonds went up 20%. That's a vector. You could, you know, gold didn't go up as much, right? So gold was an asset that inflated differently. So once you've done that, now there's a concept we'll call cost of capital. I got $500 million in my treasury. What's my cost of capital? Well, you gotta norm it against the asset inflation rate of something. I could peg it at 8%. It's a simplistic notion. It's definitely not 2%. But of course, now I guess the actual, and every product and service as defined has an intrinsic, a tendency. What is the word, like your buoyancy? Mm-hmm. Everything has a buoyancy. So if the Fed, there's a multiple, the Fed prints $1 trillion, bonds inflate immediately, stocks to a lesser extent, gold to a certain extent, real farmland to a lesser extent, luxury real estate in the Hamptons, a lot, if you in the Hamptons, but luxury real estate in Ohio, not so much, right? Hairdressing and restaurant, not. You know, so they talk about the Cantillon effect being close to the money, but there's an entire array, a vector of coefficients you can calculate, and it's a function of the construction of the product, right? Because the construction of a Caesar salad next to my table is very labor-intensive, capital-intensive. The construction of a 30-year bond, you know, is something altogether different. So really, the K-shaped recovery we see is half the world is sitting on top of financial assets that are floating on the pool of liquidity because are you heavier than water or are you lighter than water? You want a simple thing? It's like, yeah, somebody, you know, I told you there's a flood coming and everybody's going to drown. You're going to be under 100 feet of water. What would you do? Build an ark, right? So you build something that floats. You have to weigh less than the water. So in fact, if you think about that, by the way, if I take a block of granite or a block of concrete, it's 30% buoyant, right? So if it weighs 1,000 pounds, you know, it acts, like 700 pounds under the water or something. If I want to really hold something down underwater, I drop lead, right? Lead's denser. So what's the density? Maybe that's the theory. What's the economic density of any product or service, and how does it respond when you blow liquidity on it? And a chemist would say, well, everybody's got a different coefficient, right? And the economists want to tell you that everybody's coefficient is the same. And then they just want to pick everything with a low inflationary coefficient, and they want to put that in their basket, and they want to measure it. And the horrific observation, I think you've made it, is if I have the ability to rebalance the market basket, there will never, ever be inflation, ever. We had 22% inflation in the bond for a decade before COVID, and the world thought there was no inflation. But there's no inflation if you wanted a pizza. But if you wanted to retire at age 30 and work on your art or your writing or go to school or take care of your family, that inflated 22%. The American dream, I'm using cliche, retirement, that was inflating at 22% a year, running away from you while the pizza was flat. And so the bottom line is, no, I didn't write anything. You're the writer. You are the best writer in the entire industry, Safety, right? And let me say, I put the $400 million, the money into Bitcoin because I kind of went down the rabbit hole and figured it out. But I actually, in a sneaky way, I maneuvered not just to say we were speculating Bitcoin or holding it as an asset or investing. I made it a treasury reserve asset. And then we went through a tender offer where we had to let the investors decide whether they liked that idea or not like that idea. Right? When we bought $250 million of Bitcoin, we bought $250 million. We agreed to buy $250 million worth of our stock back. Right? The stock was trading 120. We tendered at 140. So I'm inverting half the balance sheet. And the other half the balance, I had $500 million that I didn't need for working capital. So we took half of it, put it in Bitcoin. The other half, we said, look, if you don't like this, we'll buy you out at a premium. We waited 20 days. The stock traded above the tender price. We got $60 million tendered to us. I have $175 million extra and some change. What am I going to do with that? Well, the next press release.
Or Bitcoin.
Well, first I'm going to call a board meeting. Because the next thing I'm going to do is get the board to adopt the fact that, no, we didn't just agree to buy $250 million worth of Bitcoin. We're going to actually implement a treasury policy. And the big idea, the Bitcoin standard for a corporation, and I think we could be a model, is we do business in 25 countries. In yen in Japan, we have working capital in Japan in yen, and won in Korea, and euros in Europe, in pesos in Argentina, in real in Brazil, and dollars in the U.S. We were on a dollar standard. We had a bunch of USD sitting all around in USD accounts. That our working capital was, we need $50 million a year. Maybe I convince my CFO we need less. We'll see. But we have about $50 million in working capital in our operating accounts. The other $500 million, we had $700 million worth of other stuff. We started buying our stock back, and then we started thinking about the Bitcoin standard, and the conclusion is you sell products and services in fiat. You hold operating accounts in the local fiat accounts. That's your working capital. You sweep your excess working capital into your treasury. You convert your treasury into gold if you're on the gold standard, or Bitcoin if you're on the Bitcoin standard. In the future, should you ever need to purchase property, purchase products, or purchase services in excess of your operating accounts, you convert your treasury back into fiat in the currency you need. If you're generating cash positive, if you're making $50 million a year, you just keep sweeping $50 million a year into your treasury. Then you have a choice. Do you buy your own stock or do you buy Bitcoin? Well, our treasury policy is we do one or the other subject to market conditions. The outside investors would say, why don't you just give us the $500 million back? Well, if I give you the $500 million back, I decapitalize the company. It's like you giving all your life savings to your favorite charity. Well, you'll feel good for a while, but if you lose your job, your children will starve. And if you care about your children, if you care about your customers, your employees, your counterparties, your integrity, I sign a 10-year lease. I've never missed a payment in my life. I've been CEO for 31 years. I never missed a payroll. I never missed a payment. I look at a customer in the eye. I swear to them, I will maintain the software. Swear, you know, that's a matter of integrity. I do business with governments, banks, you know, everybody under the sun. They have to trust me. I have to be able to make good on my promises. I can't decapitalize the company. So yeah, I'll buy the stock back from time to time if it's priced, if it's mispriced. If someone wants to short my stock, have at it, right? Like, as long as you have a strong treasury, you're not afraid of a short seller. What do you do? Drive my stock to $20 a share. I buy it all, go private. Thank you, right? Do that.
Absolutely. This was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you. Just how alien is this concept of keeping a cash balance in business these days? How much of a pariah have you become by telling people that keeping cash balances is important?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
You know, I went through this. I like Steve Jobs, you know, Steve Jobs. And you know, he's a great figure. And he had a near-death experience at Apple with you know, Michael Dell said, give the money back to the shareholders, the company's dead. And Apple almost went bankrupt back in the late 90s. And so when Apple was successful, he started accumulating cash, no dividends, no buybacks, just accumulate cash. And he did it because it was a formative experience. You know, you live through the depression, you almost starve, you accumulate cash, you're very conservative. I did things that I regret when I was a younger CEO. I borrowed money. I got, you know, my stock got shorted. We spent more than we generated in revenue. You know, at one point we went to within 10 days of being delisted, and I got within 5 days of bankruptcy and delisting. My stock went from $333 a share to 42 cents. And because I borrowed some money in a convertible preferred security, and the guys that issued the security were shorting my stock as they were hedging their security, and they shorted me, Saifedean, from $100 a share to 42 cents. Okay, so you think you can't get beat to death? Like, that's a 99.8% top to bottom fall. And by the way, I'm not blaming the world. I got the flesh flayed off my back. At the time, you know, maybe I felt sorry for myself. Now I look back on it and I realize you shouldn't spend more than you generate. And I shouldn't have borrowed money from someone in a convertible preferred, knowing they were going to short it against me, and you should be responsible and save your pennies, right? So that was 2003. You know, I got conservative and we built up $700 million in cash, but everybody else thought you're just crazy. Now, and this is where I thought I was right, but I was wrong, and they were right. But I was, you know, it's a moral hazard, right? You point out, it's like they were right because the cost of capital, according to Saifedean and the Bitcoin standard, is 7%. The cost of the inflation rate on assets is 7%. If I take $700 million and I'm yielding 1% or 2%, and that's the best I could do in short-term treasuries, I'm losing 5% every year on $700 million. So what I should have done, if you know, what you should do is you should run your build a company so that you're sure you're going to generate cash flow. I know, easier said than done, right? Build a company so you know you're going to generate cash flow. Then you know, and if you're not sure, you put a certain treasury balance, but you have to invest the treasury balance in something that yields better than cost of capital, which means no cash, no short-term government bonds. You might as well put in the S&P 500. You know, by the way, Saifedean, I wrote a book, The Mobile Wave, in 2012. You can go read it. If you Google me, you'll find a 2-minute clip on YouTube. No one watched, 700 people watched. Me sitting in my office in 2015 saying, you know, Amazon's going to dematerialize and destroy 20,000 retail companies. There's just no reason to buy anything else. Okay? No one cared. I wrote the book, and the theme of the book is Apple's going to dematerialize everybody, and Google, Facebook, and Amazon are going to crush everybody. Okay? If you bought the stock, you would have made 10x to 20x your money. It was a very simple thesis. They've already destroyed every, you know, their $100 billion networks that are dematerializing stuff. They can print products and services for zero variable cost, and they're just going to get stronger and stronger and stronger. So bottom line is, I made 50 grand on the book. You know, you can make $500 million buying the stocks. And the lesson that was taught to me,
don't write books.
Was like, if you know the future, don't write the book, buy the thing, and then tweet about it. And so, you know, like, I have a lot of opinions, but by my hat's off to you. It's pretty obvious in hindsight to figure this stuff out now. In 2020, I look at it, I'm like, okay, well, this makes sense. You wrote what you wrote, you know, what, 2 years, three, you must have been thinking about it 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, I wrote it 3 years ago, but I've been thinking about it, honestly, since before Bitcoin came around. Like, Bitcoin was the solution to a problem that I'd thought about before that.
So, it's writing the book's good, but invest in the thing.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe I meandered off the point.
No, that's... It's very fascinating what you've been thinking about, and it's so many questions I wanted to follow up on. With regards to the holding the cash on the balance sheet, I'm wondering, do you have plans for moving into using Bitcoin in your day-to-day transactions, as in making payroll in Bitcoin, accepting Bitcoin as payment, and so on?
Here's my thinking on this, and I tweeted about it today. I mean, all the Bitcoin Cash guys, they're fanatic about it. It's got to be a medium of exchange. Roger Ver has been tweeting at me, it's got to be a medium of exchange. You know, and my view is there's $250 trillion worth of assets. And there's a $250 trillion ocean of assets. Stocks, bonds, precious metals, real estate, derivatives. No one's buying a pizza with any of that stuff. Yeah, no one ever took a share of Apple stock and walked into Starbucks and complained and bitched and moaned about not being able to use Apple stock in order to pay for their Starbucks. You have a house? Try using your house to pay for pizza, right? What do you think is the transaction velocity on a house? Put it on the market, wait 6 months, get a buyer. I want to buy your house. It's 30 days. It takes 30 days and the transaction fee is 6%. You want to sell a $1 million house? It's $60,000 in 30 days from the point that someone swears they want to buy it. You know, so I got somebody's running around and they're saying, well, we got to drive the transaction cost down. We got to drive the transaction speed up. Like, you need to be able to move the asset from point to point, peer to peer, like as a settlement network. You need that. You need that for freedom. It's like I say to you, Saifedean, you can go anywhere in the world. You're free. that doesn't mean you should go to a different place every day. Now, having the freedom is not the same as using the freedom. Just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should do a thing. Stoic philosophy, Marcus Aurelius, 2,000 years ago, or whoever else did it. So I look at this and I think, it's nice, but you should sell your products and services in fiat. And you should sell your property in fiat. You should buy your property, your products and services in fiat, in the yen, the yuan, the euro, the whatever, because that's the way that 99.99% of the people do it. You should sweep your excess monetary energy into your treasury, and you should convert it to Bitcoin. So that's one last point on this, right? This, and you'll get it, the parable of the lions. A bunch of lions are chasing after a bunch of antelope. There are some lazy lions. They can't catch the antelope. They complain to the zookeeper on the game reserve. The antelope are running too fast. It's too hard for us. We can't catch them. Slow them down. The zookeeper solves the problem by hobbling the antelope. The lazy lions catch the antelope. Lions eat the antelopes. The antelopes all die. Then the lions all die. The zookeeper blames it on the weather and gets another job. That's the story of transaction fees and transaction rates on a crypto network.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's why the Ethereum, the Bitcoin Cash, all the other forks. I mean, but you know this, but you're the guy that told me it's a billion times more expensive to do it on a proof of work network, or a trillion times. But when it gets to be more than a billion times more expensive, that's enough, right? Like, it's a billion times more expensive to do transactions on the network. The reason that you want crypto is you want sovereign immortality. I want to put $100 million on the network, and I want it to last for 100 years. And on the other end, I want it to come out $100 million, even though half the government's failed and everybody debased and destroyed everything. I want to put it in, and I want it to transcend time and domain, time and space. That's a pretty good application for storing $250 trillion worth of stuff, right? But it doesn't have to move fast. And so I do think there are some interesting things that our business will look at in Bitcoin. Like, we're standing up a full node, and we're looking at the data coming off of Bitcoin, and we're looking to see if we can't thread the data sets and information from Bitcoin into our intelligence offerings, in order to provide that. But I don't feel a need to buy anything in Bitcoin or sell anything into Bitcoin. And I think it's a billion times less efficient to do it that way. So why do people get wrapped around the axle with the medium of exchange? They're trying so hard. Only 1%, a typical rich person, a wealthy person, spends 2% of their wealth every year. 98% of their wealth just sits there. The richest man in the world, right? I guess it's Jeff Bezos, is rich because of a bunch of assets, including Amazon stock, that's hardly moving ever. And by the way, when you're really, if you have any wealth, you know, the thing that doesn't get said is it's so tax inefficient to sell it that if you had, and guys in New York realize, there are families in New York City. They own a city block. They've owned it for 100 years. They have real estate on it. They never sell it. You just refinance it every year. They've never made any money, Saifedean. I have a $100 million worth of an asset. It's going up 7% a year because the asset inflation rate on real estate in Manhattan is going up, right? Probably more than 7% a year, right? If you look at it, every 10 years I refinance it, I borrow some more money. It's tax-free. I live off of tax-free debt. 100 years later, the family's got $1 billion worth of real estate, $700 million worth of debt. They're paying 0% interest on the debt. They've never made any income their entire life. You know, why would you ever generate operating income that's taxable? Everybody's just going to borrow against their assets as their assets inflate. You know, I can borrow money from a bank at LIBOR. I can borrow money for a yacht at LIBOR plus 200 basis points, safety.
Yeah.
And LIBOR is like, what? What's LIBOR? I can borrow money against a liquid asset, like a stock, at LIBOR plus 50 basis points. Why would you ever sell anything? And so this idea of like moving around Bitcoin, it's like taking the billion times harder way around the field. I got to run around the field a billion times to score one run.
Yeah.
There's only
I entirely agree, obviously. And I think the way that I was thinking of it, obviously, is if you were going to be using it, you won't be using it on chain. As I think you tweeted a few days ago, what was it? 99.8% of Bitcoin transactions would happen off chain. And I think this is something that people miss when they talk about scaling, because whatever asset you're talking about, whether it's another digital currency or physical gold or government money, you're not going to perform final settlement with every cup of coffee. It's just not going to happen. The final settlement is going to come at a much slower rate than the transactions. And the day-to-day transactions are going to happen between people who are within networks that, you know, you have repeated business with one another, so that, you know, if your credit card bounces at the coffee shop, they'll know you the next day and they'll tell you, hey, you know, get a new credit card or stop doing this. You know, their bank will contact your bank, or the credit card company will take away your credit card. There are these mechanisms for these kind of smaller payments. And that's how Bitcoin scales. And people misconstrue the Bitcoin network as a payment network, and then they compare it against Visa and MasterCard and they find much higher rates. But I think, you know, in my mind, you can add Visa and MasterCard on top of Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin will be the final settlement asset, but it'll be much better and faster final settlement than you would get with national currencies.
I think it's 100,000 to 1. Like, I think that, you know, let's take Jeff Bezos again. Doesn't he have like $200 billion worth of Amazon stock? He's got $200 billion, and that's worth all the Bitcoin is, right? The entire Bitcoin network is $200 billion. How many transactions do you think Jeff Bezos has done to sell his Amazon stock in his life? Like, I'd be one to bet you he picks up the phone once a quarter, about 10 times. He's probably picked up the phone 10 times. And he said to one guy, why don't you sell 1 million shares of Amazon for me? Click. And he put the phone down. He probably, maybe he did 100 transactions. Okay. He's just fine. You know, like that's the way it works. You're going to sweep your excess capital into a working capital account, and it's going to be on Square or PayPal or Apple Pay or in some random bank. By the way, I don't trust my bank in Argentina for 100 years. I mean, I had it fail 10 years ago. I lost $1 million in Argentina. You know, one day it was in dollars in Bank of America. The next day, by edict, it was in pesos at 1-to-1 in Bank of America. The next day, it was devalued to 10-to-1 in the same bank, and I got back 100,000, and I started with 1 million, and it was gone. I don't trust, the only two places in the world I ever lost money in a bank was Brazil and Argentina, but you don't forget those things. Having said that, I do business with banks in Brazil and Argentina today. I don't trust them for 100 years. You gotta trust them for 100 days. And so you just put the amount of money into the banks that you can afford to lose.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
1 million times faster. So it's like, how about take 1% of your money and put it into an exchange, Binance. Watch Binance. The thing is incredible. Put it into a centralized exchange or put it into a centralized mobile wallet. it's going to run a million times faster than the best idea on any crypto network. You're going to trust it. But do you really care whether Square Cash goes bankrupt in 6 months or not if you have $100 on it? Put the money on it.
Yep.
If it goes bankrupt, you're just going to move to Google Pay, then Amazon Pay, then Apple Pay. Yeah, whatever. I mean, so yep. I think people are tweeting at me like, oh, you didn't read the white paper. I read the white paper, right? But they probably say it to you too, right? Because you have an entire section where you...
No, they don't, Michael, because I figured out this incredibly powerful trick, which you really should start utilizing. It's called the block button.
Block.
Exactly.
I am learning, and life is too short, Saifedean, to try to convince
Absolutely.
A fanatic to change their mind. It's like the world's got 7 billion people in it. If you go on my Twitter and you're rude or uncivil or a jerk...
And another account.
Block. I'm not going to... I'll take 1 second, but you don't get to hang out. But yep. But your point, you said, I mean... electronic cash in a classical format. So I'm making cash delivery and settlement. This is back to the Stoic issue. You need the ability to have peer-to-peer payments in order to have freedom and sovereignty. You need the ability. Just because I have the ability to move $1 million or a dollar or $1 million or $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, I have the ability to send it to anybody anytime, and it's going to cost me a few bucks and 30 minutes. Just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should do a thing, right? The fact that you have the ability to do it 1 out of 100,000 times means that it's a harder form of currency and a better money than anything else. And I think the people that, you know, there's the phrase, right? A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. People get wrapped around the axle of doing a literal, they're like, well, that's not what Satoshi said. Well, but here's where Nicholas Taleb he's got a good insight here. It's like a semantic representation of a sophisticated idea may not be adequate. Right? I mean, like, if you come into my restaurant and you ask me what's on the menu and I say cold dead fish, you might be horrified by that. If I said it to you in Japanese, you wouldn't even know through a translator. If I wrote a book on it, you might understand it better. If I just put it in front of your face, you might think it's pretty good sushi. Just because the words don't resonate doesn't mean the thing isn't a good thing. So it's a 9-page white paper, and if you interpret it through a certain lens, you understand. But it doesn't even matter if he understood what he was saying or not. It's putting a lot of weight on one dude or a group of guys 10 years ago to extrapolate how the world was going to evolve, you know, later. So I think they had a vision, and the vision works well as a settlement network. And for people that are clinging to an orthodox interpretation of that vision, you know, 10 years later, they choose to imbue those semantic representations with their ideology. And it's crippling to the future of Bitcoin because they want to do something. But I want to make one more point. If I move a dollar from point A to point B versus $1 billion from point A to point B, isn't it obvious on its surface that the value and use of moving a dollar is 1 billion times less than the value of moving $1 billion? So they're chasing the long tail down to something which is exponentially less valuable, and they're making it a priority on a network. And that's long tail foolishness.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, you know, Nakamoto doesn't have an ownership over Bitcoin. He can't force people to use it in a certain way. And I think that the history of science and technology is full of all of these inventions that ended up used in ways where the original inventor didn't foresee. The Wright brothers, after inventing the airplane, they said, one of them, I can't remember which, he said, it's impossible that an airplane will ever cross the Atlantic. And so what, do we ban flights across the Atlantic because the Wright brothers said it can't happen? Viagra was meant to be, I think, a heart drug. Do we ban it now for other uses because the original vision was of the founder was this? You know, technology finds its way based on what people want and not what inventors say and think. And so I think that's completely misguided. But one question I wanted to ask you is a topic that I will focus on in my next book, The Fiat Standard. In that book, I'm trying to do to fiat money what I did to Bitcoin. You know, when I wrote the Bitcoin Standard, the idea was, how do I get this to an intelligent reader with no background? How do I explain to them how this Bitcoin thing works and why it matters, and do it for somebody who has zero background in how this monster works? And I think, you know, that kind of framework would be quite useful to apply to fiat money, because fiat money is 100 times more complicated than Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people could benefit from trying to understand that. And so as I started to think about fiat money as an engineer, trying to describe how it functions in the same way that I did with Bitcoin, one metaphor or one, I wouldn't even say a metaphor, it's a mechanism of understanding how it works, is that under a gold standard, gold is money. And so if you find a way that under a gold standard, gold is money. If you find a way of making more gold in the world, you're going to take advantage of it. You're going to start digging up the gold and selling it, because that costs you less than what the price of gold is on the market. Similarly, on a Bitcoin standard, people are trying to mine more Bitcoin. But on a fiat standard, everybody is trying to mine fiat. And the way that it works in a fiat standard is you mine fiat by issuing debt. So you can mine it by printing pieces of paper, but that's really the old fiat standard. Today, the vast majority of money is not pieces of paper, it's debt. It's issued by banks. Every time a financial institution makes a new loan, new fiat money is created.
Okay, so can I just stop you right there?
Sure.
I think the metaphor of a bank as a fiat miner is the most brilliant breakthrough metaphor. I read that in your paper last night. I was like up late reading it, and I got to whatever page 30, and you got to some point where you said banks are in essence mining fiat, and I thought, oh my God, that is just the most, like, no one's ever said that before. But once you get that idea, you're like, now I know why I want to run a bank. And now I realize why the world is so screwed up, because they're out of control. Okay, so keep going. But I just wanted to say, I think it's unique, seminal, brilliant. I've never heard anybody ever express it that way, but it explains so much once you have that metaphor in your head.
Yeah, it's why everybody is in debt, because every time you get into debt, you're allowing somebody else to mine fiat effectively. So your bank, you know, if you want to buy a house for $1 million with cash, that's one thing. But then if you take the cash from a bank, well, the bank gets to create $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 of new fiat out of this process. So they're going to give you a better deal on it than if you buy it with cash. And that's why you get into loans, you get into debt for your house and for your business and for everything. And, you know, individuals and corporations and governments, everybody is up to their eyeballs in debt, because getting into debt is mining fiat. So I think this might be the most vivid way in which Bitcoin fixes the world. This might be the most powerful way, because it allows us to monetize something other than debt. We don't need to keep mining debt in order to have money. We can start mining a hard asset that has no counterparty liability and that is much more solid, whereas you can build a financial system on it, because you know that the value of this Bitcoin is not dependent on counterparties making their financial obligation. But currently, you know, the choice that you would have faced with your reserves before Bitcoin was you had to put them either in cash and watch them get robbed of purchasing power every year, or you had to put them in debt and then take on to take on the counterparty risk of the governments or the agencies or all the bonds that you're using. And primarily it's government treasuries that people use the most. And I think the interesting thing to think about this is if Bitcoin leads to a reduction in the demand for debt, the reduction in demand for treasuries, because people like you are using Bitcoin as a reserve asset rather than holding bonds, then I think there's another factor that goes in, because Bitcoin is it's leading to a reduction in the demand for holding dollars, but it's also leading to a reduction in the supply of newly mined fiat dollars, because it's reducing the demand for debt, or at least if it increases significantly, you know, we're going to see 100 micro strategies. That means less demand for government bonds. So in a sense, it kind of cancels each other out. Bitcoin is not just taking the demand away from the dollar. It's taking the demand away from the dollar and reducing the supply of the dollar, which I think is an optimistic way of saying we don't have to have hyperinflation. We can witness this thing continue whereby, you know, the supply of the dollar declines and the demand for the dollar declines while the supply of the, while the value of Bitcoin rises and the demand for Bitcoin rises.
Well, I think I think that this is one of the reasons why Bitcoin should be positioned as an asset, a crypto asset, and not as a currency, because I think you have multiple monetary systems. You've got the fiat monetary system, and you know, as we said, if you put $100 million in fiat, you're going to lose 99% of your money over 100 years. And then you've got a gold monetary system. You put $100 million in gold, you're going to lose 80 or 85 or 90% of your money over 100 years, because it's inflating and it's got counterparty risk. And then you've got a stock monetary system. You've got like an equity monetary system that people are worshiping at the altar of NASDAQ right now. And they're basically floating into Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, because they think these are indestructible utilities that'll go on forever. So you put it into those, and it may be, I think you're going to lose value, because at some point they're going to get regulated and they're going to actually get chopped into pieces by well-meaning politicians, right? One way or the other. But that system has captured all the value, right? All of the wealth on Wall Street, it has surged into, first it moved into bonds, and then it moved out of bonds into the equity markets over the past 3 or 4 months. The only way you stay in bonds, by the way, there's a bond monetary system. If bonds are going to keep, if the interest rate is going to keep going down, the bonds will keep going up. So you put your store of value into bonds. And the only way that keeps working now is interest rates have to go negative. If interest rates don't go negative, the bond monetary system stops working for the wealth of the world. So they go to equity. And that's why the big tech is a crowded trade, and why the NASDAQ has gone to all-time highs and the S&P. Now, we could be at some point that stops working because the P to E's blow out, and you're valuing Apple at 3x, or you got companies that are 100 times revenue, right, that are trading on NASDAQ now. So at some point that delaminates, and now what you really want to do is position Bitcoin as another digital asset, and then you have all the people with their money in Apple and Amazon and Facebook and Google surging into Bitcoin as the store of value, right? There's a good story. This is why you don't want to curry, you don't want to curry the narrative of, well, this is for privacy and fighting the government and escaping regulations and censorship and off-chain, and we hate Wall Street, we hate institutions, we hate institutional custodians. If you're basically going down that narrative, you're inviting every government to outlaw you. And the number one issue, Saifedean, of can we have a peaceful transition from a debt economy to a Bitcoin economy, is are they going to outlaw Bitcoin? Okay. If they think that Bitcoin is Apple stock, the answer is no. If Bitcoin is Apple or Bitcoin is Google or Bitcoin is Amazon, well, you know, they'll bounce it around a bit, but no one is walking around saying we need to pass a law stopping you from owning Apple stock. Right. On the other hand, when you start talking about I want to do things to evade, you know, regulators and the like, it's like in Russia, they said you can't use it as a currency. You can use it as an asset. Right. That was the law. What you want to do is you want to position Bitcoin as an asset. And then people just sit around and say, I'm going to put my money in real estate or gold or silver or Bitcoin or Apple stock. And then it's kind of easy decision, isn't it? I mean, as soon as you know that it's not going to blow up and fail, if Bitcoin was a company, you know, or whatever, I think you see a surge. And for us to have a peaceful transition, we need to not have a situation like in Venezuela or Zimbabwe where they pass a law and they say, you can't have it. You don't want to go back to, you saw with the gold, 1934 Gold Act, right? You know, you don't want them, the government, to seize your gold, and you don't want them to seize your Bitcoin. And so to the extent that they just view it as another asset that people choose to hold and is non-threatening, I think that you'll see a migration to it. And to the extent that they see it as trying to replace the US dollar, right, then it becomes a different thing.
Yeah. So
that's what I think on that.
Yeah, but William, what do you think of the idea that Bitcoin can potentially be the final, be the way that we get rid of QE? You know, and right now, all Wall Street companies, they constantly face liquidity problems whenever there's any kind of problem in the market, and then that requires an endless amount of liquidity intervention. But, you know, if they had a proper cash reserve on their balance sheet, they wouldn't care about these liquidity problems. You know, the Bitcoin would hold its value and it would appreciate every now and then.
I agree with your idea of like fiat. Bitcoin is the fiat vigilante or the currency. But I agree with that. I think that as it gets stronger, the number one benefit of it is keeps everybody else honest. Right. Yeah. As it spreads, it keeps people honest. If the government, like let's take Argentina. If the government of Argentina knew that every wealthy everybody in Argentina had their treasury in Bitcoin, they would think twice before they print gazillion amounts of additional currency.
Yeah. Right?
It will create a discipline because the citizenry has some power, right? The citizenry can choose not to participate. So as it spreads, I think it will create rationale. I think in the absence, if you have no alternative, in the absence of an alternative, I think the politicians start to overreach.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, I used to live in Lebanon up until very recently. And you know, if you've heard the news, Lebanon's banking system is in tatters now and the currency has been destroyed.
After
I left, I realized that, you know, banks were giving insanely high interest rates to people on their savings accounts. And I just, for me, the amazing thing about Bitcoin is that all of those years I'd lived in Lebanon and I never borrowed a cent or lent a cent to my bank, basically. My paycheck comes into my bank and, you know, I use it just for day-to-day transactions and then, you know, never had to worry about what's going to happen with the Lebanese government and their solvency and all the bonds and all of that stuff. And it's amazing to think that if in 20 years' time, you know, everybody else in countries like Lebanon and Argentina had that option, then there's very, very little scope or room for the government to rob people. Just the peace of mind that comes to me from the fact that no matter what happens in all of the world's banks, in all of the world's central banks, in all of the world's governments, they'll never be able to destroy more than a small part of my wealth, which I happen to keep in any particular bank at any particular point in time. And this is just amazing. You know, it's a one-time solution to make sure that you will never get Lebanon. You'll never get the Argentina special. You'll never get that inflation. It's amazing. And I think the you know, it's only a matter of time before more and more people figure out this solution.
So Saifedean, I got to go in a moment because I've been called away to my next meeting, but I just wanted to leave you with like a couple of thoughts. Mm-hmm. While I'm sitting for days at a time and I'm trading and I'm buying this Bitcoin and I watch money, $500,000 of cash become whatever, 50 Bitcoin, and I'm watching these kind of things happen, I had this epiphany that the future, the destiny of money is to be encrypted. It's like every time I did the trade, I thought, I just took $500,000 in cash that someone can burn and steal, and I put it into a vault of encrypted energy, and now they can't get at it. And I just had this massive dopamine hit that this felt so good to encrypt my money, right? The destiny of money is to be encrypted in Bitcoin, not any encryption. But that The second observation is I just think I think your book is brilliant and your work is brilliant and you should publish again. I'm in favor of it. Let me know, I can help. And then my third observation is, if you do call it the fiat standard, I'm not converting all my money to fiat.
The plan is the opposite.
Yeah, the first one worked. The second book's probably not going to flip me back, but you go for it anyway. And I appreciate it. I love to chat with you anytime. Call me back if you like, and hopefully this was what you were looking
for. This was amazing. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time and all of your insight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Cheers. Take care. All right. Well, that was Michael Saylor, and he had a lot to say. I would have liked it for you guys to have asked him questions, but as you see, he's a man who has a lot to say, and we're all ears for people like him. So that was quite interesting. I think his analysis on inflation, to be honest, is maybe the best I've seen. Like, it's something that I've intuitively felt, and if you read my paper on food in particular, my third paper, or I think it was the fourth paper on fiat food, in which I discussed, the difference between the way that I expressed it was the ribeye versus the soy. The price of ribeye continues to go up, but the CPI continues to degrade the quality of the food. So it used to be that you could have a ribeye in the CPI, and then it became a burger, and now it's a soy burger. And so the price of a soy burger today is not that much higher than the price of a steak 50 years ago. So when you do that, the inflation doesn't look too high. But if you were to calculate it with real food, then you'd find that the inflation is higher than expected. But I think he definitely put his finger on the correct, he identified the correct mechanism, which is, I think, what he was mentioning when he was talking about, the buoyancy of different objects. I think that's really about, arguably, what he said in terms of just the scarce assets that go into it. So labor is scarce, and scarce property is scarce. If those things are needed for your economic good, and that's, the growing of a cow and processing it requires a certain amount of time and labor that just cannot be automated away, whereas you can do that with industrial sludge like soy. You can always find more efficient ways of running a factory and more efficient ways of operating these things. And so there are always ways of making these things cheaper. And this is why those things continue to drop in price. Whereas the things that are scarce, they're the ones that suffer from the inflation the most. And so CPI becomes an exercise in political management of the numbers in order to make them palatable. And that can be achieved just by deciding what you include and what you don't include. So I definitely enjoyed that. What do you guys think? Anybody have anything to add on anything that Michael said?
Just maybe to add something on the point you just talked about. Mm-hmm. I think Hayek has kind of the same explanation regarding the credit cycle, where he explains that at the end of the credit cycle, a lot of capital goods are being bid up and really expensive, while consumer goods or goods of the first and second order are really in some kind of deflationary spiral. It kind of make me think of what of the taxonomy that Michael used to explain that some goods are kind of cheap because we are in a really capital intensive end of cycle, whereas all other goods such as stocks or other capital goods have become really, really expensive.
Yeah, I think I'm not so sure how similar this is. I think there are some similarities, but I think that the Hayek story is particularly about within the cycle, within the business cycle, that the toward the late stages of the boom, there's a lot of demand for the capital goods, and that leads to a lot of competition on them, and then that leads to that leads to effectively companies going out of business. I'm not so sure it's applicable for the long term inflation that he was mentioning. What do you think, Theo? Is that the same thing?
It depends how you measure the cycle. Like if you consider that this cycle has kind of begun in the 70s because central bank interventions has prevented the deflationary phase to go on fully and readjust price correctly, I think it's maybe a way to see that. But I also just think that a lot of people intuitively understand that fiat money is losing purchasing power by the day, so they are trying to going in scarce assets to protect their value. It's maybe kind of a mix of both of the dynamics.
I think so. No, I think that's a good point. And if you think about it as a long-term cycle since the 1970s, then yeah, we're constantly witnessing everybody trying to jump up the production structure to try and have something that holds on to value because, you know, everything that's because we don't have a good money that holds on to value. So that I think there's a good point to be made there. Yeah, thanks for that. What else? Some of the other things that we wanted to discuss, I think it was you, Theo, as well. You mentioned the intellectual property law. That would have been an interesting question to ask him, but unfortunately we didn't have time. So those of you who are new here, we've had the session on intellectual property in one of the classes in Economics 12. And we hosted Stefan Kinsella. And he argues, and I agree with him, that there's no such thing as intellectual property, and that it's a distortion of the market to impose intellectual property laws that causes that doesn't really have any beneficial effects. So it would have been interesting to see, and I think it's relevant in this regard because, you know, if you think about it, in these industries where he mentioned all of these companies being able to rise and crush the opposition, I wonder how much of that has to do with just technological advancement, that they really have a technology that is better than everybody else, versus, you know, having better lawyers that are able to write laws and sue competitors and prevent competitors from approaching your business model. And I think that's something well worth considering. If anybody listening would like to take a closer look, I highly recommend Stefan Kinsella's paper against intellectual property. It makes a very strong and very convincing, in my mind, opinion for why intellectual property is not a free market institution. And yeah, anybody else?
I was actually surprised that he's not a proponent of Bitcoin circular economy yet. I thought that the purchase of the treasury asset was just the first step, and then use it as a basically training all of the employees and staff to adopt Bitcoin into day-to-day business. Because in the end, they're a software company providing software solutions for enterprise market. And you would expect that basically they would be one of the first ones to start offering some kind of solutions for their customers in terms of software, like, for example, management of payroll, management of the treasury itself, security solutions for custodying Bitcoin and things like that. But I guess the next step.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, yeah, I'm with you on this. I thought, you know, now that you're sitting on about $500 billion $500 billion worth of Bitcoin, you know, you'd think you'd want to start making it more of a day-to-day transaction currency. But no, and he's his answer is kind of compelling. There's no operational need for him to use it at this point. It doesn't offer him an advantage to be doing this, and he just doesn't see the need for it at this point. But I think, you know, with time, this is more likely to be the case. I think with time, if, you know, now he, the way that I like to put this is, you know, people will tell you, well, why don't you use Bitcoin to buy things? Well, because as long as people are willing to accept my other money, then I don't have to. As long as I can get to keep my Bitcoins, then I'm going to do that. And, you know, at this point, it makes sense to optimize for just holding a cash balance in Bitcoin in the long run and not messing with it and accumulating more and more into it. This is what I think it makes sense to optimize for at this point in Bitcoin's development. But that's a luxury we're allowed to have right now because Bitcoin is not very widespread. But in a world in which 100 more companies like MicroStrategy are holding reserves and, you know, 20% of their customers are holding Bitcoin and most of their workers are holding Bitcoin, it's going to inevitably become more and more efficient that they settle some of their bills in Bitcoin directly. And that doesn't have to be obviously on chain. It can be through the same financial institutions which they use for settling off-chain fiat. They can use it for settling off-chain Bitcoin, I guess. But yeah, he's more hardcore than even I expected in this. So chapeau bas, as they say.
Sahdin, if I was working for his company, I would ask him to pay my salary in Bitcoin, basically, because in a way, I mean, it makes sense to get paid as a salary in Bitcoin and not in a fiat currency, especially if you are in the US, basically your salary is being inflated by the month. So if he wanted to, you know, he could offer maybe to his employees, you know, who wants to get paid in Bitcoin, you know, there is some, maybe there are people that would up to that. I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, I think just in terms of transaction costs, if you think about it, for them at this point, doing a payroll in Bitcoin is probably just going to involve a little bit more friction. And when you consider it compared to the alternative, which is they just keep paying you in dollars like they always did, and then you take the dollars and go buy it from your local Bitcoin exchange, it seems like at this point, it looks like it is simpler, just because of the fact that the majority of the way that I put it is the majority of people who work for MicroStrategy today, they pay 99% of their bills in fiat. And so paying them in Bitcoin and then will then force a larger number of them to convert Bitcoins to fiat in order to pay their rent and their bills. Whereas if you paid them in Bitcoin, it'll be a smaller number of people that are converting whereas if you paid them in fiat, there'll be a smaller number of people converting the fiat into the Bitcoin that they want to hold. So I think it's a matter of convenience. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, personally, I've seen a lot of this culture of this activist Bitcoin culture of people who actively inconvenience themselves and then try and shame others into inconveniencing themselves in order to use Bitcoin. And, you know, in your early days, you can see this, like the people who go into a restaurant and then get into an argument with the waiter about, you know, maybe you should start accepting Bitcoin. And I highly, very strongly recommend that you not be that guy. You know, waiters have a lot of things to deal with in their life, and learning about the Federal Reserve System and why Bitcoin is better is, you know, not what they want to do in between taking orders. So for me, I think it's not just about bothering the waiter. It's just simply that Bitcoin is not a political movement that requires people to sacrifice and dedicate their life for it in order to succeed. If this was the case, Bitcoin would have already failed. Bitcoin is an economic invention. And so it succeeds because it serves people's economic interest. And so if people are served by it, they'll use it and it'll succeed. If people find value in it, they'll use it and it'll succeed and it'll grow. If and in that case, you know, our evangelism and our martyr sacrifices of, trying to inconvenience ourselves in order to make Bitcoin succeed, they're not going to matter anyway. And in the case in which Bitcoin can't succeed or won't succeed, in which it doesn't offer value, then, you know, all of these sacrifices also won't matter because they're not going to turn Bitcoin into good technology by inconveniencing ourselves. So I'm not a fan of this kind of, you know, I want to use Bitcoin in order to make Bitcoin succeed. I'm going to inconvenience myself in order to make Bitcoin succeed. And I think if Bitcoin needed that, then I don't think Bitcoin would work. But I think the reality is this will emerge on its own when it becomes more and more convenient. And so I know this from my, you know, I went through that phase of talking to random waiters about Bitcoin and then, you know, snapped out of that. And then I think, you know, you just start holding the Bitcoin, but then inevitably, in my case, I would say, you know, it happened to me earlier because I work in the Bitcoin space and I sell courses to Bitcoiners and I interact with Bitcoiners and I speak at Bitcoiner events. So a lot of my business has to deal with Bitcoin, that it does make sense to use Bitcoins for payment because a large percentage of the people that I'm trading with every day does use Bitcoin, as a matter of fact. And so I think with time, that's just going to increase. And I think more and more will happen. Having said that, of course, Gilad, you know, your employer is not a waiter. So telling them to pay you in Bitcoin is acceptable. You know, don't expect them to agree initially. But if more and more people do this, you know, they're more likely to see the use case and then start to understand it.
No, I agree. It's not practical, but maybe just to like every employer, he needs to put some money in the IRA accounts, or you know, that the people are not using for them, and then maybe it makes sense to save it for them in Bitcoin or something like that. But you're right, it's not practical.
At least for now, I'm sure it'll get more and more practical with time.
I think what's brilliant about Bitcoin is that it transcends politics and religion when you talk about martyrdom and all of that, which, you know, currency, or that was originally what it also did, but Bitcoin transcends what that transcended. And this guy that was talking today, he's a rich guy for the reasons that he gave about holding on to it instead of trying to use it to help people or, you know, whatever. That he's just continuing to do what he does to be the guy that he is.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody, I can't remember who, but they said something along the lines of holding Bitcoin is one of the most, I think it was Bitstein, Michael Goldstein, I think. He said holding Bitcoin is one of the most charitable things you can do. And I absolutely agree. And just recently I got an email from somebody who's who read my book, loved it, and they've started a business that's using Bitcoin and trying to spread awareness about Bitcoin. And they were asking me, you know, making a donation to something that helps Bitcoin, and if I had ideas. And I told them, I think the best donation to Bitcoin is to buy Bitcoin. You buy Bitcoin, you're helping the network bootstrap. You're helping secure the network. You're rewarding, you're giving more money to the miners that are securing the network. And, you know, hold it and don't sell it. You support the price, you bring it up. And you help the network grow. It sounds very very vulgar almost to say it, but it's true. The more people hold Bitcoin, the more the value of Bitcoin rises, the larger the amount of liquidity that is held in Bitcoin, the larger the number of mutually beneficial exchanges that can happen between Bitcoiners. The more that people can use Bitcoin, the more that the value of Bitcoin rises, the more, and when all of that is happening, then, you know, on the other side, the demand for government money declines, and the ability of governments to continue to inflate money away declines. And so if you want to bring that about, if you want to help that come about, you can't really do much better than just holding Bitcoin. I guess a second best thing would be get on Twitter and start posting with all the rest of us, memeing a new global monetary system into existence. But really, holding Bitcoin is the number one form of philanthropy and activism, I think, in the 21st century, if you want my opinion.
Yeah, and it's only vulgar if you think that self-care or, you know, cultural expansion are a bad, if you have some small-minded moral judgment about that.
Oh, I agree. I think, you know, the notion that looking out for yourself is somehow vulgar is generally propagated by people who want to take advantage of you and whose interests are not helped by you looking out for yourself.
Right, or who want you to take care of them.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, anybody else? What else do you guys have?
Well, I thought it was an interesting observation that he did, that he realized that their cash was deteriorating at a higher rate than they were making money, than their profit. It's
yeah.
kind of obvious when, in hindsight, but I wonder how long time it takes until other major companies realize this.
Yeah.
It shouldn't take long.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we saw happen in 2020 is going to really accelerate this realization because I think, you know, the next couple of years are going to make the inflation of the past couple of decades look like a joke. And even if we don't get inflation in the dollar, I think there's going to be so much inflation around the world in all the other national currencies, it's going to get ugly. I think it's, you know, the 1970s and 80s, we're going to be reliving a lot of that in the next few years. And it's going to open a lot of people's minds. In the 1970s, the price of gold shot up from $35 to $800 over the course of a decade. And that was the only inflation hedge at that time. Well, that and silver. Silver is not much of an inflation hedge, but those were the only two options available for people. And these two have the significant disadvantage of being physical and being extremely lacking in saleability across space. You know, you can't pay with gold across national borders. It's enormously complicated and enormously expensive. So even with gold crippled, it still managed to go from 30 to 800. Now, this time around, we don't have we have a gold with wings, basically. We have gold that's not crippled. We have Bitcoin that can, that is saleable across jurisdictions, can travel across jurisdictions. And it's absolutely mind-blowing to imagine what happens when people realize this is an alternative and it works.
Saif, just a follow-up question on that. Mm-hmm. Given all that's happened with the coronavirus and the economic damage that's been done as a result of that, are you surprised that we haven't seen more inflation already?
To be honest, not much. I think, you know, there's an enormous amount of reduction in spending caused by the fact that people are stuck at home, which is huge, you know. So a lot of the things on which people used to spend money just don't happen anymore. Like a lot of the businesses that go into the CPI in the period of March, April, and May and June, you know, all of the expenditure on these things was zero. You know, the expenditure on baseball games and basketball games and theater and movies, all of that went to zero. And so that helps balance the CPI because all of that stuff goes into the CPI. I think the way that I like to think about it so far, here's how I'm formulating this. And I want to have more of an in-depth discussion of Corona economics in one of these seminars in the coming week. But the way that I look at it is that, you know, think about the U.S. is the place where we have the most data, maybe. In the past 6 months, since mid-March, we've had more than, I think, 60 million new unemployment claims filed in the US, which is just absolutely mind-boggling as a number. The first couple of weeks, we had around 3 million, then 6 million, then 4 million, then 3 million every week. And then the numbers kept dropping and settled at around 1 million for the past 3-4 months. Every week, there's another 1 million or 800,000 or 1.2 million or something like that. So that's an enormous number of jobs lost, an enormous numbers of business, an enormous number of businesses shut down. And the way that I see it is, since this happened, we've moved to a new economy, which is, you know, it has a lot more. It's a lot more unemployment. It has a lot fewer businesses. It has a lot less production taking place. But we haven't adjusted to this kind of life yet. So some people are beginning to adjust. You know, people who lost their jobs are reducing their consumption, and they're drawing down the savings that they've had from before, and they're using government checks and so on. This is kind of slowing down the come down, if you want. You know, you're slowing down the. You're slowing down the adjustment process for this, but you know, you're not reducing the damage. In fact, you're exacerbating it because you're borrowing from the future. So you're softening the speed of the crash by effectively borrowing from the future and in effect making the crash a little bit heavier in the long run. So the way that I would think about it is that we're not in the recession stage of the corona crisis yet. We're in the boom phase right now. So if you've studied Austrian business cycle theory, you know, there's the boom phase is when the credit expansion happens and the credit is spread out. And then the crash comes when the credit expansion has to stop. So we're in the, I would say we're in the boom phase of the of the new post-corona economy. We're in the boom phase where people are still living like the halcyon days of 2009. People are still living close to what they lived like in their terms of their financial means in 2019 for now. But, you know, government checks will probably stop at some point. Or if they don't, you know, we're going to get very high kind of inflation. I think, I think the real crash comes in a few more months or in a few more years, when this kind of liquidity needs to be readjusted. When we, you know. So stocks are up massively since the corona crisis, but jobs are down and consumption is down and expenditure is down and the number of businesses are down. So there's a huge disconnect between the fundamentals and the financial asset prices, which are propped up by more liquidity. Mm. And the consumption at this point, you know, the day-to-day life for most people has not been massively impacted yet because of the fact that it's being adjusted. But, you know, it's like, think about it this way. You go through a crisis. The first few months you're spending, you go through a crisis. And if you're going through a crisis for a few months, you can spend most of your life saving in those few months. Because you think that, all right, in those few months, you know, I have this crisis, but then I'm going to get back to work. I'm going to get back to normal and life will return. But I think what a lot of people are going to find is that there's no going back to normal. You're going to spend your life savings and then you'll find that, you know, your business is gone and all the other businesses that could have hired you are gone. And an enormous amount of capital is being destroyed. I think this is really the key thing. The destruction of capital, capital is very hard to build. It's very hard to figure out how to build a business that's successful and profitable. And, you know, it takes many, many years and trial and error for somebody to build a business in a neighborhood that is successful and profitable. You know, they try and build a Chinese restaurant and then it doesn't work. And then somebody else comes in and they build a laundromat in this place. And then it turns out it doesn't work. People don't need laundromats in this business. And then somebody builds a new business, and, you know, bookshop or whatever. And then that turns out to be successful. Well, then, you know, you put these people out of business for 6 months, the entire capital that is embodied in the people and in the good and in the location is out of commission. It's you know, the machinery is not being used. The machinery goes out of service. Machinery degrades, and then it becomes impossible for the guy to restart. All the people who used to work there have moved out of town because they can't afford to pay rent anymore, and then it just becomes impractical for that business to restart. So now you can't just pick up the pieces and pick up where you left off.
Yeah.
It's going to be many years until we're able to build a business that can replace this. And so I think the real cost is still to come. And in particular, you know, in the non-US part of the world, I think this is where it's going to be the most badly felt, because in those places, you know, governments are going to inflate massively, and that's going to cause enormous problems. I just think about all of the sovereign debt crises that are coming along. Like in 2019, we already had enormous debt burdens, and then everything is doubled and tripled in the last year. So yeah, I think we're still in the honeymoon phase of the corona crisis.
If I just can add something about this matter of inflation, I totally agree with you on the spending side. But the other thing that can explain why we haven't seen that much inflation, I guess, is also the working of fractional reserve banking, because since money is destroyed all the time when loans are repaid, and because banks' balance sheets have been really impaired because of the containment, the lockdowns, and the business engage in more loan giving after the phase of PPP programs and stuff like that, where they were basically forced to give out loans on which they didn't have any liabilities, but now they don't want to lend anymore. So basically, the amount of money newly coming in circulation is decreasing. So it will be, for a time, really hard to get inflation. But after that, when government will respond to the consequence of this slowdown in credits, we will have massive printing and checks with money that basically cannot be destroyed on the same process. And because production function has been totally impaired because of the lockdowns and stuff like that, and capital destruction, as you said, I think it's at that point that inflation will really take off.
Yeah, thank you. That's probably a better answer than mine. I think the key point is, and Ahmed is asking in the chat, why not in the US? I think I should just, the point that Theo is making is, under a fractional reserve banking system, when you get a recession like this, you are witnessing an enormous amount of destruction of the money supply. A lot of the money is destroyed because businesses go bankrupt and loans get written off. And so loans are taken off the bank's balance sheets. And so the money supply is declining and banks' ability to make new loans declines. And so this is why you may not get fast inflation in crises, because on the one hand, you're getting the destruction of the money supply that is going along with the increase in the money supply by government printing. So in other words, if you think about 2008 and 2009, the central bank was printing many trillions of dollars that were given as liquidity to banks, and yet we didn't witness enormous price inflation, because you have to remember that there was trillions of dollars that were disappearing from banks' balance sheets. And so what ends up happening with each crisis is that during the boom phase, everybody is speculating in assets that have high risk and relatively low liquidity. So you put your money in speculative assets like, you know, mortgage-backed securities and corporate debt and junk bonds. These things can pay you a very high return, but they have a high risk, or at least a higher risk than cash, than holding on to cash. Now, when there's a crisis, when there's a financial crisis, people don't want to hold junk bonds. They don't want to hold credit default swaps. They don't want to hold even stocks. They prefer to hold things that are much easier to liquidate and things that you can use to pay your rent and your bills. And so they'll hold cash and they'll hold treasuries. And that's why those things appreciate. That's why, you know, in 2008 and 2009, you see the dollar appreciating, because all over the world, and the dollar in particular, because all over the world, the global financial system is built around the dollar. And when all of the speculative assets begin to look shaky, everybody all over the world is looking for dollars. And you see this today. We're beginning to get more and more of this dollar crunch now, where people are going over and over, where people are demanding more and more dollars. And so this is why I think outside the US and outside the euro, at least, I think we're going to witness inflation with currencies other than the US dollar and the euro. I'm not entirely sure what the case is with the dollar and the euro. It could go either way. I don't have strong opinions on it. I've seen people eloquently make the case for why we don't get inflation. And I've seen people make the case for why we should get inflation. I would not be surprised with either when it comes to the dollar and the euro, because it's really hard to predict, you know, how much money is going to be destroyed in the financial system and how much printing is going to take place. However, as Theo is saying, yeah, there's when you move from let's give liquidity to the banks into let's give money directly into everybody's bank account so they can spend it on stuff. Well, you know, then the inflation will move from the assets. And if you remember the earlier with the discussion with Michael, he was saying the three tiers of inflation. When, you know, he talks about things that go between 8 and 20% per year, like the stocks and financial assets and bonds. And these things that you would use as a store of value, these continue to appreciate more and more. And so that's because of QE. That's where the QE money goes. So if the QE, if we don't get QE, or if we, on top of the QE, we get things like universal basic income and we get money going directly to people's pockets, well, then the inflation is going to start showing up in the consumer goods. So it's tricky to make predictions about how this is going to pan out. And to be perfectly honest, one of the best things about Bitcoin for me is the fact that you don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. And, you know, so far, at least, even after 6-7 months of the corona crisis, Bitcoin's price is still up about, I think, 30% on the year. So it's about 30% higher than where it started the year, I think, something like that, 30-40%. And that's maybe even 50. And that's incredible, you know, given that everything that we've gone through, still the price is around 50% higher than it started. It's reassuring that Bitcoin continues to exist and function in the real world, even as these problems happen in the fiat system. And it's liberating as an individual and as an economist from having to continue to engage in this endless game of, you know, guessing and tea leaf reading and trying to figure out what is the central bank trying to do and what is the central bank, how is the central bank going to respond and how is the market going to respond to the central bank? And then what's the central bank's decision going to look like in response to the market decisions? It's a lot of second guessing, which, you know, it's sad that this is what passes for capital markets today. You know, in a healthy economy, capital markets would be places where people look at productive businesses and assess their business models. Now the whole thing is just one big giant bet on what the central banks are going to do. And frankly, I don't particularly see it as being something that's intellectually interesting, and I don't find it to be, you know, and thanks to Bitcoin, you don't need, but before Bitcoin, you had to still engage in it if you wanted to eat, you know, you had to figure out what's going on in order, if you wanted to save anything, you know, you couldn't just have cash and you had to be in the markets and you had to figure out what was going on in the market, and that had to be very difficult. But now it's just getting, it's getting possible for us to just, you know, exit the fiat system and watch all of their games and not have to worry about what's going to happen to well, you know, obviously it's still going to affect you because it'll affect your job and it'll affect your non-Bitcoin assets. But the fact that you have the safety net of Bitcoin is really liberating, because it makes these discussions far less consequential to your life, which I think really is the case, how things should be. The idea that your financial situation is dependent on what the central bank does is, I think, an absolute travesty of our time. It's insane that anybody in the world needs to know who Powell is. It's insane that that job exists, but it's absolutely criminal that people all over the world need to figure out this guy's psychology and what he's going to do and how he's going to act and how he's going to react to the market and how the market is going to react to him and how he's going to react to the market reacting to him in order for you to have savings. You know, you can't just have a normal job where you do your job and you get paid and then you put your money in a savings account or in a coin and watch it hold on to its value. No, you have to do tea leaf reading, you know, in order to maintain any value into the future.
Yeah, I totally agree on that point. It is very depressing how much people take for granted inflation. You know, my parents are currently seeking financial advisors and things to try and just to try and preserve their savings, you know, going into retirement. And it's kind of like, you know, inflation is just taken as a fact of life. It's not, most people don't seem to question it. It's just something that, you know, neither party in the UK really talks about. It's just one of those things that's part of the system that we all accept. And it's good that Bitcoin offers us a way out of all of that.
And a way out of arguing with people and trying to convince them about it. That's the best part. I mean, if you don't like it, you know, fiat coins are always there for you. You don't have to join Bitcoin. It's a very underappreciated feature.
Saif, can I just add something? It was a great interview, and I don't want to like blow smoke up your ass, but like your analogy to banks mining fiat, that caught me off guard. It clearly caught Michael off guard. I don't know who else here found that. Where did you drag that one up from? That was brilliant, and it's going to be a huge meme going forward when you drop that on the mainstream. And look forward to using that to kind of, you know, bat down the naysayers when needed, you know, like the Ponzi schemers.
It's in the fiat standard, which is in the works right now, but parts of it as well are in the second of the 7 research bulletins that I have on my website. So if you go to my website, saifedean.com/research, there are 7 papers which I'd written to subscribers about a year and a half or 2 years ago. This is the second one, Bitcoin monetization scenarios. And it's basically my argument for why Bitcoin doesn't have to cause hyperinflation. I'm elaborating it and refining it for the fiat standard. So stay tuned for that. I need to get to work on the fiat standard and start writing more and more. But, you know, I'm also writing Principles of Economics as well. But yeah, I need to get back to work on these. Speaking of which, maybe now is the time to end today's discussion so I can get back to writing Principles of Economics and the fiat standard. Thank you very much, guys, for joining. This was a lot of fun, and I really appreciate you being there, and I appreciate all the questions that you sent, and I will see you next week. Take care.